Welcome to this fifth Wednesday Forthright Radio for May 31st, 2017. I'm Joy LeClaire. We have a very full show for you today. It's our last Radio Goes to the Movies for the 2017 Mendocino Film Festival show. With us for the full hour are two people who created the amazing film The House on Coco Road, Damani Baker, director, writer, producer, and Mendocino County's own Belvie Rooks, who was one of the producers of The House on Coco Road. Damani Baker is a native of the San Francisco Bay Area, who is one of Filmmaker Magazine's 25 new faces in independent film. His career spans documentaries, music videos, museum installations, and advertisements. Some of Damani Baker's documentaries include the film we'll be discussing, The House on Coco Road, which revisits the events and circumstances of the 1983 U.S. invasion of Grenada, and also Return, an award-winning film that explores the genius of traditional African medicine. He directed music videos for Maisha's single, Wannabe, which was nominated for a 2009 Grammy, and which you can view on YouTube, and Morley's Women of Hope, inspired by pro-democracy activist Aung San Suu Kyi. His first feature documentary, Still Bill, was on the life and music of Bill Withers. His current projects include over 10 films for museums in Nigeria and Chattanooga, Tennessee. These films include interviews with President Bill Clinton, Dr. Kofi Annan, and President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. In addition, he is a professor at Sarah Lawrence College's Film and New Media Department, the director of the Quest for Global Healing film series in Bali, Indonesia, and media collaborator with the International Budget Partnership, tracking government transparency through budgets around the world. We welcome you to Forthright Radio, Damani Baker.
Joy, it is a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure, I assure you. And also with us is Belvie Rooks. And Belvie is co-founder of Growing a Global Heart. She is a writer, educator, and producer whose work weaves the world of spirituality, feminism, ecology, and social justice. She is a former board member of Bioneers, the Urban Habitat Program, and the Positive Futures Network, Yes Magazine. She is currently chair of the board of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, as well as a board member of the Institute for Noetic Sciences and the Jesse Smith Noyes Foundation. Belvie Rooks is a core faculty member of Holy Names University's Culture and Spirituality Program. Her published works have appeared in a number of books, publications, and anthologies, including The Same River Twice, Honoring the Difficult by Alice Walker, My Soul is a Witness, African American Women's Spirituality, and she was co-editor of Paris Connections, African American Artists in Paris, which was an American Book Award winner. Belvie Rooks, we welcome you to Forthright Radio.
Thank you so much, Joy.
This film is so many things. It's a family history of sorts, hence the title, The House on Coco Road. But it's also a chronicle of the historic revolution in the tiny island of Grenada by the New Jewel Movement. And Jewel stood for Joint Endeavor for Welfare, Education, and Liberation, which was co-founded by Maurice Bishop and Bernard Cord. It's about the destabilization under the Ronald Reagan regime, leading to the invasion and overthrow of the government there. And as if that weren't enough, it also chronicles the rise and government repression of revolutionary Black activism in the United States, featuring Angela Davis and her sister, Fania Davis, and of course, your mother, Fannie Houghton. I don't know how you got all this into a mere 79 minutes without making it feel rushed or over full, but let's begin with what ties it all together, The House on Coco Road. What is this house, and why did you call the movie this?
Thank you, Joy. It really, when I hear it described that way, I too wonder how we got all that in there, 79 minutes. And before talking about, you know, the house on Coco Road's title, John Fine, who is a collaborator, dear friend, and editor of the House on Coco Road and my previous work, Still Bill, is truly a brilliant artist and musician in his own right. And I think part of how that came together and using John's gift of storytelling helped me get all that in there, because we are so many of those things. It's when you look at the timeline of this film, we cover almost 100 years in less than an hour and a half. I have to give my hat off and many thanks to John Fine for putting up with me and showing up to his studio literally with boxes and boxes of material that was this complicated and yet beautiful puzzle that's my family story, kind of told through my eyes, through my mother's eyes, through my great-grandmother's perspective. That's part of, I think, how that came together. And honestly, the title, The House on Coco Road, really, I think, says a lot about the journey that the film is in itself. You know, I went to Grenada for the first time as a director and filmmaker with Belvy and her grandson Jelani and my mom and a whole crew as a very excited graduate student in 1999 to tell the story about my family's life experience in Grenada before the invasion and what our life was like living through an invasion led by Ronald Reagan. I think in many ways not to make the film. I went back to Grenada to figure out what this story might be. And I happened to have this camera to kind of revisit a lot of my life there. And so that film, you know, was 60 hours plus of material. After almost a month of filming in Grenada, I get back to L.A. where I was living at the time, and I'm looking at it going, well, you know, this is an incredible, I think, document, but I don't know what it is yet. And many, many years passed, Joy, and Belvy will definitely speak to this. It took 15 years before getting to this point. You know, that first shoot after a year of fundraising that Belvy helped facilitate and along with the Sundance Institute that supported the project, you know, got us down there. We shot this film. We come back, and it sat on the shelf for a long time. You know, I'd gone through footage at different moments over the past 15 years trying to figure it out. And one thing I did keep doing in process was having conversations with my mother. So she now lives in Atlanta, and I would go to Atlanta with a camera and continue asking questions, because there were things in that material after our Grenada shoot that were left unanswered, that weren't clear, and I didn't feel like I had the glue that would tell the family Grenada story. And so you see it in the film, but there is this moment where I discover a box in my mother's basement that had hours and hours of Super 8 footage that documented my family's migration west from rural Louisiana. You see my great-grandmother at home. You see my grandmother and grandfather packing up the car to leave to move to Los Angeles and start a new life. It was almost the first migration of, you know, we're having all these conversations about what it means to leave home and set up something new. My family was documenting that from the 1950s to 1970s up into my mother's graduation from high schools. So The House on Coco Road, I realized, was more than the Grenada story. And that's why part of the reason it took so long was because, you know, I'm not Grenadian. This is one chapter in my family's story. We happened to be there during this incredible moment in their history, in our own lives, you know, hiding under a bed when the United States invaded. Things that, obviously, I've never forgotten. But the box opened up a new piece of the narrative that helped me figure out much of who my mother is and her journey and path to activism and why we ended up in Grenada in the first place. Because you see other women in my family that we weren't calling them then, but were brilliant activists, change makers, thinkers who were doing whatever it took to provide a more livable condition or life for their families. And so to kind of redefining and rethinking activism from my great-grandmother's lens and my grandmother's lens to my mother, to Angela Davis, to Fania Davis, to Belvy, all of that lived, I think, in that box that happened much, much, much later. And the house on Coco Road is literally a house on Coco Road, which was named after my great-grandmother on the land that my family family sharecropped. And so the family still lives in that area. And after my grandmother passed, they named the main road through our town, I like to call it, Cocoa Road. And so I said, well, you know, I think this film is about family. This film is about family history. This film is about women activists in my life. And Grenada is now the glue that holds that story together, because it didn't happen until much later. So that was just the tail end of my mother's journey that I got to experience as a young person. So that's really how that title was born. And I didn't realize back then in 1999 that title carries the weight of a legacy of really incredible people in my family.
Kudos to John Fine. He did a superb job. And Belvy, I want to invite you to, even if I don't ask you a specific question, to feel free to join the conversation wherever you feel it's appropriate. Now, Domani brought up your work as far back, just in terms of this film, speaking of your work, as far back as 1999 to make this happen. So what did you see as your role in birthing this film?
Well, my actual role was not really so much initially focused on the film. There's an extended family context. I knew Domani when he was 9, before they went to Grenada. I had the chance to visit my friend Fanny Houghton, who's, you know, his mother, and, you know, we were all part of a kind of activist extended family. And so when she and another friend, Jean Wiley, decided that they were moving to Grenada, I actually went to Grenada to help them get settled, to kind of see what they were leaving in Oakland and what they were moving to and how to be helpful. So I had the pleasure of seeing Domani as a 10-year-old in Grenada, he and his sister Kai and my godson, Cabral, who was also around 10. And, you know, these young people who had left Oakland and were just free, you know, would leave home and walk on the beach and you weren't worried about them. And they were seeing a 35-year-old head of state that felt like an uncle when you saw them running up to him and being hugged. So my initial entry was really as friend and supporter of the family move and the vision that was Grenada, the kind of what the New Jewel movement stood for. And so like many people, therefore, as the violence, the rhetoric of invasion escalated, I was like many African Americans particularly, and then progressive people around the world, following with bated breath what was happening, because I knew children who were there during the invasion. And so it was really, that was the entry point. And then fast forward, Domani's 10, and then fast forward, you know, he applies to film school and gets accepted to every film school he applied for and decided to go to UCLA. And I guess I wasn't surprised when he was graduating with honors and announced that his culminating MFA project that he would get graduate degree from was a script about Grenada. We were all excited, but I remembered that summer, I'm not sure, he was a graduate student, and I said, you've written the script, when are you going to start doing the film? And he said, yeah, I've got to get a job, I don't have, you know, there's no money, and, you know, and I just remembered saying, well, you just graduated, it's June, you're not going to get a job before September at the earliest, so we have a window, and why don't we make this happen? And I gather a lot of people were saying the same thing. Domani has a lot of mentors, and so that's how, and so I then, and one of those historical footnotes is that one of the first people I called and introduced Domani to was Fanny Shakur, Tupac Shakur's mother, who had just set up the Tupac Shakur Foundation, and I was really excited, and she was excited, and she asked to meet Domani, and I think she wrote me the first check from the Tupac to help get us there. So that's kind of a long version.
I'm so glad, Domani, that your experience seems to have been quite different from your mother's experience. In the film, it's brought out that your mother, Fanny Houghton, had been told that She went to Washington High School, but she was told she was not college material. So she didn't even consider applying to UCLA. She went to Cal State LA instead. Talk about her experience as compared to your own back at the end of the 60s, early 1970s.
Sure. You know, I mean, it's funny when you hear it that way. It was, I think, pretty traumatic thing to be told that at that age. But in a way, I'm looking back at the kind of history and how it's all played out. Everything happened, I think, as it was supposed to, within that context of meeting Angela then when she did go to UCLA. You know, so she really was at the right place at the right time. If she'd gone any earlier, maybe that relationship wouldn't have happened, and Fania wouldn't be part of our lives in the same way. So it was a different time. I mean, she was at UCLA between 1968 and 1972, and you think about what's happening in the world, and some of this is in the film, it was just, the world was explosive. She within a very short amount of time, was part of a campaign to defend Angela's job at UCLA when the UC Regents, led by Governor Reagan, were trying to get her fired. She fed children at the Free Breakfast Program, Black Panther Party's Free Breakfast Program in Los Angeles, when the police raided their headquarters. And she stepped in not because she was particularly driven to be a Black Panther or a member of the party, but as someone who was studying early childhood education and development, she saw a need that needed to be filled, and that was feeding children. And the simplicity of just providing a hot meal to young brown and black kids in that period was hugely significant. And then eventually, as we know, history goes on, and Angela's story unravels, and my mom's part of the Free Angela Davis Committee and moves up to Oakland, California, where I'm born in 1973. So if you think of like 1967 or so to 1973, I mean, it's incredible what was happening and who the leader, what the leadership looked like at that period. And, you know, some points in the film that are kind of funny when Fania and my mother talk about kind of fleeing to Cuba when Angela is wanted by the FBI, and you hear it, and it's for John and I in the edit room, we're kind of chuckling because it sounds so extreme and intense and brave at the same time. I might say that we're in a very similar period in the world right now, where in a very short amount of time, I think a lot of actions are being born, and there's a lot of new leadership that are looking to this period of activists like my mother and Fania and Belvy and Angela for the way forward. So I hope in people watching the film, we continue having conversations about this very important moment in history, because there's a lot to learn from it. So in many ways, it's both a painful truth that my mother was told that she couldn't make it at UCLA, and then a blessing that she ended up there exactly when she did, because I think UCLA needed her. I think Angela Davis and that relationship and Fania, that gave birth to a movement that I am now a part of. So I'm really grateful for that period in time. And thinking back to how we got all of that in there, one thing John and I talked about in our edit sessions was keeping the family lens on history. And so when we would look at the big historical timeline of Geismar, Louisiana, and the black migration west or north, all the way up to Grenada, we would ask ourselves, you know, who's telling this chapter? What lens? Is it your mother's? Is it you? Is it your sister's? Is it your father's? Whose lens is going to guide us through history in these different scenes or beats along the way? And so that one was really fun because it was my mother's story. I have incredible footage of her in her cheerleading outfit in 1960. I have footage of her walking alongside Angela Davis that we found in the NBC archive when people were protesting her dismissal at UCLA. And so we kind of kept the family story as the anchor through history. So that's how we were really able to, I think, tell something that felt truthful and honest about these moments in time that I was not even born for. That's kind of how, that was our approach to that. So I appreciate kind of unpacking that very specific time, because it was the launch pad for so much of what comes later in the project.
You talked about the various characters. We can't leave out Ronald Reagan. One of the things I most appreciate about the film and there are many things I most appreciate, is the balancing of the role of Ronald Reagan, first in California politics, with, as we were just discussing, the early activism of your mother and Angela Davis and Ronald Reagan, and then his administration when he was president and what he did, not just in Grenada, but in Central America and Latin America in general, with his what has come to be known as alternative facts. And the parallels, as you pointed out, with our current situation are very stark. Belvy, you mentioned about the solidarity movements in the United States. They were very active in Mendocino County in the late 70s, early 80s. And a part of my heart broke when Reagan's military invaded Grenada and overthrew the revolution. And I don't think I've buried it, but it was such a hopeful time with revolutions happening in Grenada, in El Salvador, people's revolutions, Nicaragua, and the role of the United States in first destabilizing and then overthrowing. Damani, why don't you begin, but Belvy, feel free to jump in. The whole process of destabilization and control of information.
Yes, it is. You know, there's one thing someone asked me at a Q&A recently, and the question was kind of, when did you realize that there were alternative truths to kind of what you've been taught? And you see there's a piece in the film where I come back from Grenada, and while, you know, my peers were celebrating G.I. Joe and Rambo and other kind of violent representations of bizarre nationalism and imperialism, I had a lot of questions, even at age 9, because what I understood in terms of what was possible in terms of humanity was a Grenada model, you know. And Belvy mentioned, you know, Prime Minister Maurice Bishop, who would shake your hand and say hello. I saw women in positions of power. I saw and understood healthcare as a right for all people, education. So that those were the policies in place that were new and unfamiliar to our family and why we left Oakland in the first place. But even as a child, I felt safe. And that level of safety where I could take the bus by myself with my little sister, who was 5, and go to school, and felt like there was a community who watched after us. And so to come back and be told that where you just left was this horrible, communist, terrible place, I think I started to question information even back then. If I'm honest, I can credit Grenada and the Grenada Revolution for my wanting to be a filmmaker, and particularly a nonfiction filmmaker whose job is to seek the truth and question information as it's shared. So it is a very interesting time, and that moment sparked a long, you know, now 43-year-old path of questioning how I'm told I'm supposed to live. And just as I mentioned, the simplicity of taking care of children and healthcare and education as things that should be a human right. And so Ronald Reagan did become the obstacle in that journey. And I remember hiding under the bed with my mother and my sister and one of our aunties, who also was our roommate with her young son in Grenada when we lived in the Limes. And we would do our prayers, and I think, you know, my mother and Yvonne were worried about our safety. But I remember connecting Ronald Reagan to what was hurting us, even that young, and that he continued to pop up in my family's journey over and over again, from firing Angela, from, you know, the expansion of the prison industrial complex in California as governor, to becoming president and being connected to the total breakdown of communities across the country with the influx of drugs and sending people away forever. And then here we are in Grenada, and I'm still connecting this person who became a three-dimensional character in my life, to the invasion of Grenada and the person who was getting in the way of what I had imagined or had experienced as something beautiful. So yeah, he's a character, and I make light of it in the film. I think we're still suffering from many of his policies today, to date. And so this character who was so destructive still rings in many of what I think we're having conversations about now. So he is definitely a character in the film pretty consistently. And I think when by the time you get to the end of the project and the film, I'd love for the audience to reflect on information and how it's shared and who is sharing it and what their motivation is. And just in the power in asking, the power in questioning, the power in saying, no, there, I know there's another way, for me, was born out of my experience in Grenada, for sure.
Reiterate kind of what Damani has said and your expression about the grief and the heartache that, you know, you experienced during that time and then revisiting it. And I think that one of the reasons that it was so important to go to Grenada was to see for ourselves with our own eyes. And so there were people from the Scandinavian countries. Damani mentioned an aunt from London. I was really struck the summer that I was there. I was there the summer before the invasion. I was really struck by you meeting Norwegians and, you know, people who were hopeful around the world had come to Grenada to kind of help this small, fragile democratic experiment. And so one of the exciting things about being there, what it was like the model UN. You were hanging out on the beach with people who had left their countries. You know, there were French people and there were people from all of the Caribbean islands, like Fanny and like my friend Jean Wiley, who took her son, who basically were showing up saying, what can we do? And that was very hopeful. And so I feel like I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to go and visit and see, because I remembered during the bombing and the invasion being in San Francisco and being terrified and not being able to get through to Grenada. And so people around the country were on the phone all times of night. Have you heard anything? And we're looking at the news talking about this Cuban Soviet outpost and that the U.S. is invading to save democracy. The disconnect between the reality and the question that you were raising about alternative facts. One of the things that I love about the film is that the interrogation throughout of alternative facts, that is, the so-called quote-unquote alternative facts, Angela is a terrorist, not much mention of the feeding children or in terms of the Panther Breakfast Program, people being killed in their beds in Chicago through COINTELPRO. So there was always this lens that, well, wait a minute, what we're being told is not what we're experiencing. And it's very interesting to have the country catch up because, you know, African-American social justice and political activists throughout the 60s had no illusions about destabilizing our organizations, and Fred Hampton being killed in his bed in Chicago, sleeping next to a pregnant wife. These were things that really gave us another kind of lens in terms of who we were and what we're dealing with. And it's, so it's interesting in these times as we see the erosion of social and civil liberties at a number of levels that people are generally becoming more conscious.
Some amazing quotes showing Reagan and hearing Ronald Reagan talking about the excuse for the invasion was that an international airport was being built, 10,000-foot runway. Ronald Reagan says, Grenada doesn't even have an air force. Who is it intended for? He talks about Cubans with Soviet financing and backing. The Soviet-Cuban militarization of Grenada, in short, can only be seen as power projection into the region. It isn't nutmeg that's at stake in the Caribbean. It is the United States' national security. The concept that this tiny little island, it's 12 miles by 21 miles. It has a population of, what, 150,000 then, anyway. That this represented a security risk, it's laughable. It's laughable that if Nicaragua fell, they were only 12 hours by tank to the Texan border. I mean, this sort of stuff is... How did they get away with it? I don't know.
Well, one of the things, Joy, that I really... love in terms of the evolution and unfolding of the film that I feel like John, Damani and John did brilliantly, and I know that it was one of Fanny's passions, was to put the focus and the emphasis on what was working and on this dream and on this experiment and who those actors were, because it's the focusing on that that both informed what was hopeful and why as a model, and placed Ronald Reagan in a context, in a larger context, and the larger context being the celebration of the vision of Maurice Bishop, of the Grenadian people, because I feel like often we in this country don't get to see enough of those kinds of models, you know, and so who the actors really are. And he was an actor, but and what I love about this film is he is a minor actor in the unfolding story. Would you say, Damani, that
sure. And you know, he's just a representative for a much larger conversation about what former colonies are still processing, what imperialism looks like, what the irony and the comedy in his quote that you shared, Joy, about you know, a threat to national security. And I think if we reframe that conversation and talk about what real threats to humanity look like, I think if we put that conversation into the mix, we actually see Reagan and many other characters in the United States and abroad that seem like more important than their minor and patriotic. That sounds kind of insane, actually, when you think about it that way. But, you know, the threat to humanity and what that looks like. And so when you think of Reagan and his actions, he was just this guy playing out this myth built on supremacy, built on white supremacy, built on the annihilation of indigenous people, built on free labor. And so when that myth gets played over and over and over again, then you end up with an entire cast of characters and positions of power that are so destructive that if we have conversations only about their not small, because people lose their lives over these actions, but if we don't begin to pull back and say, whoa, none of this is acceptable, and there's no place for that in the sustainability of the planet, then we can have a real kind of imagined future that I think I experienced in Grenada. Because what if Grenada was actually allowed to exist? I mean, I often think of that. And making this film over all these years, I wonder, what if this actually was allowed to play out, this experiment of justice, of community-run government, of something that most people may never experience in their lives? What if this was actually allowed to play out? How would we frame the conversation about what's happening on the planet if this model became the new exercise that happened across the world?
Yeah, and I do want to say that even though I may get overwrought about the topic sometimes, this film manages to have overall an extremely hopeful aspect to it. If nothing else, it chronicles your own family, Damani, from very, very terrible roots under one of the most, well, basic slavery as sharecroppers in Louisiana, up to your current position, Damani, as an up-and-coming filmmaker who's getting recognized for your gifts and doing a film like this one. So I don't want to give listeners the impression that the film is doom and gloom, because it's anything but.
Well, thank you.
Well, and I think what's interesting also, Joy, and I think, I mean, probably Damani, you know, isn't as overwhelmed by the positive responses as some of us are, because it just is amazing to have had sold out performances twice at the LA Film Festival, sold out 600 in Oakland, people not wanting to leave the theater. I've just been really blown away by the response that people have, and they start to see their own personal family story in the context of a larger global reality. And that also, I mean, I guess that response around the country and the globe, and even in the Caribbean, where the film was and, you know, won a documentary film festival award there with Caribbean People in Toronto. So what is really wonderful about the film and exciting for me is that it seems to be at the very center of an emerging global conversation about possibility. And that's very, very exciting. Yeah. And I'm really excited also that, you know, there's all this good news, and, you know, there's a distribution is in place, and it's going to be, there's going to be a huge launch on June 30th on Netflix that Damani can talk about, because we've been doing the festival seating, but now we get to take it to a whole other level. And it's just really interesting that Mendocino Film Festival will probably be one of our last film festivals before it goes into theatrical release. And people, we're going to have a big campaign in Mendocino around June 30th and the Netflix launch.
It is so exciting, and I think, Troy, you nailed it. It really is a film that I hope inspires people, and then through telling the truth about what's possible, people see that in themselves and their own communities. As Bellevue mentioned, you know, we've been traveling with it for about a year now to, you know, close to 20-plus screens across the country, and sold-out shows at the Grand Lake Theater and in New York, and the Q&As sometimes go on as long as the film, which is a great sign that we're still in conversation for another hour after the project. And it's not even just how did you do it, or, you know, which I appreciate those questions too. You know, what was it like to raise money for a film, or what was it like to direct something like this? But 90% of the conversation is about the content itself and this period in history in Grenada and my mom's story. So that is so rewarding. I mean, it's unbelievable. There was a Q&A here in Brooklyn at BAM a couple months ago, where we had Decima Williams there, former UN ambassador, and the Caribbean community came out. And, you know, Brooklyn as a center for a West Indian community in New York, and it was packed. I mean, standing room only. Q&A kept going, and there was someone who raised their hand, and she said, you know, I'm from the West Indies, I'm from the Caribbean, and this film made me feel connected to my African-American neighbors. And she felt like her experience in Brooklyn in particular had been very intimate in terms of her Caribbean family and the community that she knew the most and felt the most connected to. And in seeing the film, she had a more global perspective on how connected we all are. And she's like, you know, I'm looking at my neighbors differently, because we live in Bed-Stuy and Caribbean community, and there's a traditional historical Black community in Brooklyn, and I feel like we share more than I knew. And that was just that's the icing on the cake. That's why we make art. That's why we go through the 15 years that it took to get here. So that's just so incredibly rewarding, because you don't realize the stories that are also in the room. So there's the film that I made that goes up on the screen, and then there's, you know, anywhere from 40 to 600 independent narratives that show up that are absorbing and sharing as well. That's a huge, huge moment for me in my career. When I made Still Bill on Bill Withers, there was a similar response to seeing a retired African-American 70-year-old man who was a father and partner, and yes, a soul icon, but if you can succeed in creating an experience for someone where they see themselves and question things in their own lives in a positive space, then I think I'll keep making things. And so now we are going into our distribution with Array Ava DuVernay's company, which we're really excited about. She made the 13th and Selma. And so we're very excited about their model. They have a huge grassroots mobilization model that it's incredible. I mean, I've been getting texts and emails and tweets from people who I do not know that are part of their network, that are volunteers, who are people like me who are excited about storytelling and believe in the work that they put out. And so across the country, around our launch date, there will be massive pushes across the country from a community of volunteers to steer people to screenings that are happening in their cities to the big launch on June 30th on Netflix. So we're thrilled to be partners with them, and I'm very excited. I mean, the fact that after this 9-year-old kid from Oakland leaves Grenada and many, many years later makes a film about that experience is now a film that is now physically present in the lives of people across the planet is a huge moment for me, I think a huge moment for our family and all of the mentors that helped me get here. I mean, Danny Glover, who is also a producer on the project, not only as in a producing role, but as a mentor and dear friend and in the film business. I mean, just I would watch him, and not just because I think he's a brilliant craftsman, but he also found the balance between his activist work, his compassion and passion for community building and performance and being on stage and being in front of the camera. So I've had some incredible models along the way. I mean, Michelle Indigocello, who scored the entire film before Grenada's project started, was someone who I admired and had a deep respect for in terms of how she creates sonic experiences. And so this is definitely feeling like a blessed moment for the project, and hopefully people will feel that as well when they watch on Saturday in Mendocino, which is a whole other story. I mean, I don't know how much time we have, Belvy, but, you know,
I was just about to say that the Mendocino part of this story is just quite extraordinary. And I remember people like Zita calling, you know, this film is being sold out and seen all around the world. When are we going to get to see it in Mendocino? And so we're deeply grateful to the Mendocino Film Festival and to Pat Ferrero and, you know, all of the people who came down to San Francisco to see the film and who were really advocates for it here. And we're, you know, and particularly grateful for Queenie's Cafe, who just, the minute it was announced, I understood that Lynn said, we're sponsoring it. So for me, this has been a very challenging year for me. All of my Mendocino and Mendocino friends have really held me during the passing of my beloved husband, who loved Mendocino and Mendocino loved. And it feels, for me, like a real moment of healing, because I just, you know, had to leave and take the 18 months to just kind of deal with that reality. And so coming back to Mendocino, to the film festival, feels, and with Debani and Cameron, it feels like homecoming. And so I just am deeply, deeply grateful to the Mendocino community for all the love for all these years.
We have about 2 more minutes. I have so many more things I want to talk about, but I think I'm going to let Damani, you get to have 45 seconds for a last word.
Well, I think just to echo Belvy's sentiment, there are just many, many thanks. As you mentioned when we first started speaking, the layer upon layer upon layer that I think we try to capture in this film. What's behind this film are many, many, many lives. I think it is a celebration of hope. I think it's a celebration of a dream that not only my mother had, but Maurice Bishop had, that his mother, Alimenta Bishop, Belvy, Fania, Angela, Didon. It is a culmination of many spirits, and and I wanted it to feel that way. My partner, Cameron Russell, who has watched me go through the past 2.5 years of second round fundraising to get it done and helped me launch our last push Kickstarter campaign to come up with funding. The Sundance Institute, who also invited me to Utah to the lab and then helped me fund the last portion. This is a project of many, many voices and spirits that I think truly believe in what we were and continue to do. I sit and I watch it in the back of the room sometimes, and I feel like I'm in a shared family experience. I'm watching my own family on the screen, and I'm feeling the energy from people who are my family who I don't know. That's the ultimate gift of a filmmaker, and honestly, it's the ultimate gift as just a participant on the planet, that I'm surrounded by people who share a vision of a more livable and sustainable world.
Belvy, I'm sorry you only got 15 seconds, but make them good.
Well, I just am looking for, you know, we sold out everywhere, and I'm just looking forward to seeing all of our friends on Saturday. It's a love fest.
Okay, those are good last words, too. Thank you both so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio, Belvy Rooks and Jemani Baker. We really appreciate it.
And thank you, Joy.
Thank you, Joy.
Our guests today on Forthright Radio have been Jemani Baker and Belvy Rooks. We've been discussing their beautiful, important film, The House on Cocoa Road. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LaClaire. Forthright Radio now has a website, which you can access by going to forthrightradio.wordpress.com. And of course, the views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KZYX's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors.